Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the rise in the medical kidnapping of ill children. We have a very large panel today. We're going to speak with Terry LaPointe, an investigative reporter and writer for Health Impact Medical News, the Kidnap Division, a new website reporting on incidences of hospitals and child services kidnapping children from their parents for medical reasons, and to provide resources to families whose children have become victims of this practice. She has long been a passionate advocate for mothers and infants, with her background in home birth, midwifery, childbirth and breastfeeding education, and doula work. She holds a degree in cultural anthropology and world missions with a minor in behavioral science. And she speaks publicly as a voice for the voiceless. In addition to writing for Health Impact News, her articles also appear in other publications. Then we'll also be speaking with Michelle Ryder. Michelle is a licensed practicing nurse and a mother of Isaiah Ryder, who is now 17. Her son has a very rare condition called neurofibromatosis, which causes painful tumors on nerves. Isaiah has undergone multiple surgeries, including complications. When Michelle decided to seek a second opinion, the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, which is supposed to specialize in such conditions, ordered Child Protective Services to take custody of the child from her mother. Both Michelle and Isaiah were told by hospital officials they would not see each other again. Michelle lives in Kansas City, and her son was placed in a foster home later in one of the worst sections of Chicago. She has a Facebook page entitled Team Isaiah. We'll talk about her case. We also have Dr. Mark Feldman. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry, an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. He is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and the author of over 100 peer-reviewed papers in the professional literature. Dr. Feldman is highly regarded as an international expert in Munchausen syndrome, commonly known as a psychological disorder, whereby a person feigns disease and illness or psychological trauma to draw attention and sympathy. He has been subject of hundreds of articles appearing in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, USA Today, and others. And he's appeared on television substantially, including 2020. He's a graduate of Dartmouth College and Medical School, frequently serves as an expert witness in court cases, including in the case of the medical kidnapping of Isaiah Ryder by Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago's Child Protective Services. We'll also be speaking today. Again, this is a larger-than-normal panel, but we felt that it was necessary to have all the different voices on, with Randolph Kretschmar. Randy is a Chicago attorney specializing in mental health law. He entered law later in life in order to better advocate for universal rights to citizens to refuse psychiatry and psychiatric medications. He is a longtime admirer of the work of Dr. Thomas Saws, one of the great American social moral critics of the medical community, and he has been associated with the Citizens Commission for Human Rights, perhaps the nation's largest nonprofit mental health watchdog organization. He is presently the attorney for Michelle Ryder and her son's custody case against Lurie Children's Hospital and the CPS in Chicago. And finally, we will have Lori Blaylock, the mother of Catherine Hughes, born in June this year with a rare condition, and which is actually not a true syndrome, but congenital facial abnormality that includes a cleft palate, small jaw, and obstruction at the tongue base. Following an incidence of seizures a month after her birth and following the medical guidelines from the University Medical Center Children's Hospital in Lubbock, Texas, shortly after the infant returned home, the hospital and child protection services returned to take custody of the child. Now Lori only gets to see her infant for 2 hours every 3 weeks, and she has a Facebook page, Bring Back Catherine Home. We'll talk with her. Nice to have you all with us today, and we're going to begin with Terry. Terry, first, explain to this audience what is meant by medical kidnapping.
It's kind of a term that has just grown out of what we're seeing with children being taken by hospitals and medical staff in conjunction with Child Protective Services. And to a parent or to an outsider, anybody looking from the outside looking in, it looks like kidnapping. They're taking kids. They're not taking kids from homes where there's abuse or molestation or anything like that. It is actually medical staff in conjunction with using the Child Protective Services to take children when there's a medical disagreement or parents asking for a second opinion or something like that. And so we can't really say. To me, it's not really just taking a child legitimately. It's a kidnapping. They took somebody that they have no right to take.
How prevalent does this appear to be with hospitals throughout the United States? It's something that the major media has not written about.
It's something that, honestly, I didn't realize was happening until just a few weeks ago. I know many of us have heard of the Justina Pelletier case, but I didn't realize how prevalent it was. And I'd written a few stories, and then I was recently contacted by the editor of Health Impact News to investigate these stories because I'd written about a little bit of it, and he said that since they've been covering the stories, they've been getting inundated with people calling in or contacting them saying, help, we're facing the same thing. And I have seen the same thing, and I'm getting contacts and messages from people really all over the country in all kinds of different places saying, we're seeing this too. This is happening. This has happened to my grandson. This happened to my nephew. I've watched it happen. And I had no idea how prevalent it was, and so that is honestly why Health Impact News formed the division called Medical Kidnap, to address this, to give the parents a voice, to be able to talk about it and let them tell their story. And I'm seeing it happen so much. And one thing that I had actually made a comment in a story that I'd written about the disturbing trend that we're seeing, and somebody said, this trend, like we're just now seeing this, has been going on for 20 years. I had no idea. And I think that maybe the majority of mainstream America has no idea that this has been going on with our neighbors and our friends and people around us, and we had no idea it was happening right there.
It's not too dissimilar in that respect from what we saw during the past 20 years. Parents saying that their children were developing normally, hitting all their speech, walking, movement, eye contact, until they had massive amounts of vaccinations all at once, and then began to rescind and began to lose that contact and that growth. And it was only after some of these parents reached out, started websites, that they found out that they weren't alone. There were hundreds of thousands of parents dealing with children. Some parents had multiple children that this had happened to, and now we see an epidemic of autism that is tremendous as a challenge to society, and it's been denied. It's been completely denied by the vaccine makers, by the medical community, by the federal agencies. And at the same time, instead of having an honest, impartial examination of the facts, the parents were simply, their story was not getting out. Now it is, and scientists, physicians are coming forward to take a look. So the question is, now that this is getting out about medical kidnapping, I'm sure that you're going to have a lot more people responding saying what happened to us too. What do you find are the most common phenomena? Explain how it actually works. Give us an example of this.
One of the things that is alarming to me is almost all of, if a child has what they're calling a rare genetic condition, if there's some kind of a medical condition, the child's been under a lot of medical care, one of the things that is honestly freaking me out is that the hospitals that are connected with this have a research study going on that is studying coincidentally the same rare genetic thing that the child has. And I've seen that pattern. And sometimes it's easy to find and sometimes it's not so easy to find. But the hospital just happens to get funding for this, for some weird malady that that few people have ever heard of, and then a child comes into the hospital within weeks or a month of that research project beginning, and then the child is there's trumped up charges and things that are made, accusations of the parents with doing medical abuse, meaning that they're trying to make something up and make the symptoms up. And the interesting thing is that once a child is a ward of the state, the state has they can do medical research on these kids and use them as lab rats or guinea pigs with nobody's permission. They're just, I mean, it reminds me of Nazi Germany or something. It's very bizarre, but I've seen that correlation in many of these cases. And then another thing that I'm seeing is that I'm just starting to see is if somebody does things that are alternative. There's someone who doesn't vaccinate, does home birth, wants to breastfeed, wants to use herbs and homeopathics and alternative medicines. Then it seems like they're instantly suspect. Their child is fair game by the system.
You're listening to Terry LaPointe, who is an investigative reporter, a writer for Health Impact News Medical Kidnap Division, and talking about now that she's aware of this, it's opened up the sleuth gates and a lot of people are coming forward. Let's go over now and say hello to Michelle. And Michelle, please share your story about Isaiah.
Yes, Isaiah went to Chicago, we went to Chicago in March. We were seeking specialized medical care. And Isaiah had a surgery at Lurie's on March 31st, where he was having tumors removed from his, he has a below the knee amputation. That was actually from, he had a fracture when he was 6 years old. And he developed pseudoarthrosis. And so from the age of 6 to 15, basically he had many surgeries to try to heal the fracture to his leg. And most all of our care was in Kansas City for 10 years, where he had those surgeries, which resulted in the below-the-knee amputation in August of 2012. So basically, going forward to Lurie's, he had the surgery, and during the surgery he developed complications where he was under anesthesia, he was asleep, and his legs started moving involuntarily. And that continued after the surgery when he woke up and got progressively worse. These were seizure-like movements. They didn't start out that way, but they kind of built up to that. And they were not able to manage his pain. It was very evident after they had tried two additional procedures, took him back under anesthesia, trying to do procedures to control the pain, and they failed to do that. Those procedures did not work, and he was ultimately admitted to the ICU for pain management. And after those procedures and after I witnessed doctors saying that they didn't know what to do, they didn't know what to help him, my son was getting worse, he wasn't getting better, and he was suffering. He was in a lot of pain, and these were lasting for hours and days and weeks. And so I requested a transfer to another hospital. I felt like my son, you know, deserved that, to have another set of eyes, another set of hands. And Lurie's did not honor that request. Instead, they took my son from me. and I was not able to see him. He was in the ICU for 30 days. When they took him from me, they actually didn't even have a court order. So they took him from me on the 15th of April and didn't even actually have a court order until the 23rd of April. So there was 8 days where they literally, you know, didn't have an order to take my son. On the 23rd, the judge did write an order for me to be able to see my son, but the hospital would not allow me to see him. I even went up there with Chicago officers, and they tried to help me see my son. We live in Kansas City, which is about 550 miles away from Chicago. So, you know, I was there by myself. My parents had actually been there with me when they found out that he was doing poorly in the ICU, but they had to rush back to Kansas City. So after they left, it was just 3 days that they actually took me away from my son. Again, I didn't see him for 24 days, and when I did see him, he was transferred outside of the hospital. He was very, very heavily medicated on a lot of medications that he wasn't on when he went into the hospital. And again, he was put in foster care in a very bad area in on the south side of Chicago. In fact, after we did research, we found that 97% of all cities in the United States are safer than where they placed Isaiah in the name of protection. During his time there, he had his safety was put at great risk. He came from a very different neighborhood, a very different home. He was not used to that, so he was just kind of just basically thrown there and said, here, you're going to live with this stranger, and never mind the life that you've been living, this is what you're going to do now, and you just deal with it. And he was held at gunpoint twice. You know, he's basically was traumatized. And he is now back in Kansas City, but we are still fighting the state of Illinois. He's back in Kansas City, but he's not home. He's still considered in foster care. He's with my parents. He's 17 years old. You know, he wants to have his life back.
Michelle, there's something I'm not understanding. And
sure.
You're a licensed practicing nurse.
Correct.
You deal in the medical system. You're part of it.
Correct.
What exactly would have motivated the people at Lurie Children's Hospital in to say that you're unfit and your child shouldn't be there, since what you're telling me, all you asked was that since he was not responding to the treatment, that he should have a second opinion? Is there something beyond this that I'm not aware of?
No, there's not. That is correct. And it wasn't until that point. So Isaiah was 16 years old. He just turned 17 in August. So it wasn't until that point. So we were 2 weeks into the hospital stay, and we've had years of, you know, medical care, and that was the first time that ever that anyone has said that I was, you know, has accused me of being a medical child abuser. In fact,
they had to say something to the judge for this to be gone forward. What did they accuse you of in court or in their papers?
Well, their allegations were. In fact, I asked him what medical child abuse was. I've been in healthcare for 16 years, and I had never heard of anything like this. You know, I do believe that most people, I mean, we're taught that doctors and hospitals are safe, and doctors just don't take your children for no reason. But their claim was that I was interfering with their care, with what they wanted. But this is my child, and my child was suffering. You know, they also claimed that I wanted him on strong medications, which was not the case at all. In fact, they had tried on two occasions at Lurie's to start him on methadone, in addition to all the medications he was on. I was not comfortable with that because he was not responding to any of the narcotics. I mean, he was he was on many narcotics, and he was still in a lot of pain. So,
okay. Michelle, I want you to hold your thoughts, because I want to bring, and that's, you're listening to Michelle Ryder, licensed practicing nurse, who is now without her son because of the hospital saying she was unfit and or a danger to her son. Let's now speak with Dr. Mark Feldman, a clinical professor of psychiatry and adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, and also a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and an author of over 100 peer-reviewed papers in the professional literature. Welcome to our program, Dr. Feldman.
Thank you.
Dr. Feldman, normally you've testified in court cases in favor of the state. Why in the case of Isaiah did you feel it was important to be a witness on their behalf?
Well, I have to go where the facts take me. And I generally do testify for Child Protective Services. But in this case, the first thing I saw was a video of Isaiah in pain with his left leg, the leg that had had the amputation, vibrating so quickly it was actually a blur. It was a tremor that he was having that he had no control over. And yet the hospital staff seemed to be dismissive of the amount of pain he was in and the fact that psychological factors couldn't have led him to move his limb that fast. My perception then, and it continues to be the same today, is that the hospital didn't like Michelle's manner, her way of being very assertive, not being disruptive, but being emphatic that her son, Isaiah, deserved better treatment than he was able to get at Lurie. And once I recognized that was the case, I became quite an advocate for reunification and remain that way now. The state has been has wanted to win this case very desperately. That's clear. I could tell that when I was testifying a week or two ago. But I don't know that winning and doing justice are necessarily the same things. And in this case, I fear that they are not.
One of the main problems we're facing in this case, and another we will hear from later, is who has the authority to say a parent is unfit to care for a child unless there is a clear past record or a history of abuse or criminal activity or a history of unfit mental illness. And even among some of those cases, I don't feel that the state has the right to take children away unless there's a certain proof that the child is endangered. What are your thoughts, please?
My thoughts match with what you've just said. The critical issue, as I see it, is has the mother done something in a medical child abuse case that, such as falsely reporting symptoms or exaggerating symptoms or actually inducing medical problems? If any of those things have happened, then, and she's doing it because she gets some sort of emotional gratification out of the attention and sympathy that she and her child get, if that happens, I get very concerned and testify for the state. But in this case, the state has acknowledged that Michelle never did any of those things, and yet they're pursuing it as avidly as I've ever seen in one of these cases.
What would be their motives?
I think that Michelle struck them as being ungrateful, somewhat uncooperative, unduly persistent, and questioning. She questioned the core of their competence. And I don't think they decided to turn around and angrily accuse her of medical child abuse. I think unconsciously they decided that the mom has got to be the problem here. If we can remove mom, then everything will be fine with the child. And they were mistaken about that. And now no one from that side seems to want to turn around and say, okay, maybe we rushed judgment, or maybe we were over pushy when it came to what we saw as being what Isaiah needed as opposed to what his mother needed. The positions have become more inflexible, and that's been disappointing to see.
I'd like to have you respond to something that is not directly pertaining to this case and possibly any of these cases, but I'm seeing all the time. We did a program of over 100 women who over a period of years had undergone different types of cancer therapy and had succeeded 5 years after their treatment. They were cancer-free. So at the time of the interviews, which took 2 weeks on the air live, 10 per day, we had all these positive testimonials. That was very good. What concerned me, and to this day we do not have a real handle on, in every single case where the physician, the oncologist, or whoever was treating the person, when it was not their protocols, not their therapy, that was the primary reason the people had improved, but other protocols, the person was dismissive. One woman in particular, and these were advanced cancer patients, by the way. It took us almost 2 years to prepare this program because we had certain criteria. You had to have terminal or end-stage cancer. You had to have therapies that had helped you beat this cancer and stay cancer-free. But then this part of it, when in each and every one of the 100 cases I ask, now that you beat your cancer, you were healthy and alive, did your original attending physician, whose therapy was not working, was that person open and interested in the therapies that you were using, whatever they may have been? And the answer was no, not one. To the contrary, as one says, well, you know, whatever you're doing, it's working, keep doing it, but didn't want to know. Do you believe, or do you believe there's any basis for suggesting that one of the underlying, possibly even subconscious aspects, as you have in this case, a highly educated woman, experienced in medicine, who's had years in the field, who understands what happens in different cases, and because of her background, being able to be forthright, and that might have been perceived as a challenge to their authority, their ego, their sense of belief that they have the therapy and they're not going to allow someone to come in and challenge that. Do you believe on any that there could be a psychological component to all of this and that could be behind the motivations?
Yes, I do. I think you've stated it perfectly. I think that is the dynamic that's operating here. A certain degree of professional arrogance. You know, when we go to medical school, we expect to emerge as leaders in our communities, certainly leaders in the medical field, people that others look up to. And any erosion of that or any questioning of that is viewed as almost intolerable. And I think we see that played out in Michelle and Isaiah's case.
Okay. Well, good. I appreciate these inputs. And what do you think will be the next step in this?
Well, I followed the direction of the attorney, Randy Kretschmar, and I know that there are further hearings scheduled. I am always hopeful that the hospital and the state's attorney will increase their flexibility, but there's been no sign of that so far. So it's going to be up to the judge in the end, I'm quite sure.
We appreciate you coming on. I know you have to leave and sharing your insights, and thank you for the help that you've given this family.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Mark Feldman, his website is munchausen.com. Now, I want to come back to you for a moment, Michelle. During your visits to your son, while he was no longer in your custody, what can you share about how he changed? And was he being drugged? And anything else that can give us a perspective on this?
Yes, he was. When I first saw him, I believe it was somewhere around at least 10 medications he was on. All of those, most of those mind-altering. In fact, the one medication that he really needed, he was taken off of, which is prescription vitamin D. He also has, in addition to the neurofibromatosis, he has kidney disease. He has cysts on both of his kidneys. So His vitamin D level goes very low, and he usually can tell he's very fatigued. He doesn't feel well, is not able to concentrate. In fact, when he came back to Kansas City, he had been off it for at least a few months, and he was taken to the doctor, and his labs were drawn, and it was low. So he remained on, in the hospital, he was started on some medications, a lot of medications, but in particular, he was on a benzodiazepine they were using it to try to control the movements, but it wasn't helping. And they kept him on that. In fact, he stayed on that for 5.5 months until he returned to Kansas City and was weaned off of it. Currently, he's not on any medications, but he was on a lot when he was discharged from Lurie's.
Okay, thank you. Please hold on. Let's now go over and we'll say hello to Randolph Kretschmar, a Chicago attorney specializing in mental health law. Nice to have you with us today, Randy.
Nice to be with you, Gary.
What would you like to add to what Michelle and Dr. Feldman said, and why do you feel it's important to take this case on?
Well, the state's alleged, just to get oriented in terms of the legal situation, oddly enough, Illinois is more or less the home of the concept of the juvenile justice system, and many people would take some pride in that, I'm sure. Unfortunately, I think it's been degraded to the point where it's completely shameful. The actual petition that was filed in the Ryder case alleges three separate causes. They allege that Isaiah was medically neglected by his mother, apparently because she obstructed or somehow refused to explore the treatment that Lurie clinicians considered proper. Secondly, they allege that Isaiah's environment is injurious to his welfare, apparently merely because of his mother's presence. And thirdly, they allege that Isaiah was medically abused by his mother, apparently because she instigated dangerous or potentially dangerous treatment at Lurie's. Now, to begin with, you have to consider that it's rather curious. These three... Hello, did I lose something?
No, you're still there.
Hello.
Okay, yeah. I started to say how curious it is that all three of these separate allegations are supported in the petition by the exact same set of facts, which are cut and pasted. And there seems to be no necessary thought about any motive at all. In other words, no reason why Michelle might be abusing or neglecting her son. Yet, of course, there's a presumption that no one else could be responsible for any negative clinical results. Now, to me, I said this in our opening arguments in this case. There's an analogy. Suppose that I agree to take care of my neighbor's house plant while she travels for a couple weeks, and the plant clearly is not responsible for itself, and my neighbor's out of town, so it's all on me for the plant's welfare. Now, if my neighbor returns to a dead plant, she's going to want an explanation. And if I say, well, you know, maybe I didn't water the plant, or maybe I gave the plant too much water, my neighbor's probably going to ask which one, because they couldn't both be the true cause of the same dead plant, right? Now, medical child abuse is actually defined as a child being deprived of necessary medical care. It happens when a caretaker is responsible for a child getting too much care. neglect medical neglect is a child being deprived of necessary care, and medical child abuse is a child getting too much, right? Anyway, they can't both be simultaneously alleged using the same identical facts, and yet in this petition for wardship of Isaiah Ryder, that's exactly what the state did. They expect the court to somehow arrive at a firm belief or conviction that the state's evidence supports not only one proposition, but also its opposite.
Randy, there's something that is simply not proper here. On the one hand,
that's right.
The mother at no time interfered with the treatment at the hospital. They did everything that they could. They had him in intensive care for 30 days. The young man was not responding to pain medications. They had him on multiple medications, none of which did they ask her approval before they did. None of the medical procedures were asked. A complication occurred during surgery, by the way, which is very common. Iatrogenesis, or medically induced injury, is rampant. In fact, my own study and a report that I did that you should become aware of is called Death by Medicine. Five top scholars, all MDs and PhDs, myself included, with a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, and a professor and a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology. Plus, we had oncologists, we had professor of neurology, board certified Dr. Martin Feldman. We had all these scientists. We worked for 5 years to look to see how much of medicine as currently practiced is actually scientific based and is it safe and effective. And we found that the number one cause of death and injury in the United States, way surpassing heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, was medical treatments, the treatment itself. And yet there's been not refuted. In fact, the Journal of the American Medical Association came up with the same conclusion, except they put it at number 3 because they didn't add in people dying of bed sores in hospitals, meaning they got the bed sores, the ulcerated conditions in hospitals. They also, this does not even include people dying at home from complications from medical treatment or medication that they used and died because of complications from medications at home. That's not even included. We had anywhere from 600,000 to 1 million people per year. So when I hear that there were problems in the operation, when I hear that they were trying every medication they had, when I'm told that none of the medications were helping and that it was not stopping the seizures, causing the rapid movement, at no point is the mother, who is Michelle Ryder, a licensed practicing nurse, she's not participating in any of that. She is simply witnessing it. She is there to observe and see her son. Only when it's at that late stage does she suggest a second opinion and have another hospital, see if they can help the son. Then this kicks in. How could any judge in the United States say anything other than this is malfeasance on behalf of the hospital and its staff, and this is not indicative at any level, nor is there any prima facie evidence that this woman engaged in anything representing child abuse to have her child taken away. Those are my thoughts. Please challenge them and deconstruct them.
Well, here's the thing, Gary. It can't be a very compelling argument to say that Michelle Ryder was just too rude to doctors at Lurie in April, so therefore it's dangerous for Isaiah to live with her. It's likewise not compelling to suggest that she's generally just too anxious about his medical condition. Mothers get anxious, particularly when their children have serious chronic health problems. If we need to eliminate all danger of maternal anxiety, we have to eliminate mothers. So When the state says that there's some danger from to Isaiah from his mother or from his mother's presence or from his mother's involvement in his medical treatment, they have to distinguish this alleged medical child abuse from iatrogenic difficulties, or from, for that matter, medical malpractice. Now, doctors are supposed to know better than parents, who are not doctors, what medical treatment will help a patient and what medical treatment will hurt the patient. If doctors give bad treatment, and that's supposed to be medical child abuse rather than malpractice, then seems to me the parents or the caretaker had to at least have fooled them with some kind of false information, or somehow instigated this bad treatment. And clearly, referring back to this petition for wardship, you know, when a mother willingly brings her child to a hospital and checks them in herself and signs all the forms and asks for treatment, and later they try to say the child was medically neglected through no fault of the doctors or the hospital, then the doctors in the hospital had to have been very thoroughly fooled, somehow browbeaten into not just doing their jobs at all. So,
but
it's such a ridiculously unlikely,
Randy,
theory.
Randy, that makes no sense, because
exactly.
They did all the doctors, the hospital did all the blood work up. They did all the histological. They did all the studies. None of that was done by the mother. So if there's medical negligence, it's the doctors and the hospitals. If there's iatrogenesis, it's the hospital. It looks like a lot of people are trying to cover themselves from both medical error and human error, but also there's an aspect that is unnerving. The more educated you become as a patient or a patient's advocate, the more threatening you become to the system. A lot of people no longer are going in there and just keeping their mouths shut. They're educated. The internet allows them to seek out information. There's GreenMed Info and a lot of other places to get facts. So that's what I'm seeing here. All right, so let's go back over for a moment to Michelle. Michelle, in your case, have you thought that it might be better to go public and get the media involved? Because frequently, especially in cities like New York, Los Angeles, and especially Chicago, you have so many organizations, the police organizations, the medical organizations, that have control unless they are exposed. Then they start to back off. Have you thought about doing that?
Well, I tell you what, at first, when I was faced with this, I didn't know what to do. I didn't even know it was possible that, you know, a hospital could take your child from you. I didn't know what was going on. When I was taken into a room by a doctor that I'd never met in my life, had never seen my son, a social worker that I'd never met in my life and had never seen my son, and they told me that they were taking my son from me for 48 hours, is what they told me. I didn't know what was going on. I had never heard of anything like that. So as far as going to the media, you know, after I wasn't allowed to see my son for 24 days, even with a court's order, I started talking with other people, and I think the biggest thing was I had made a call. I was making tons of calls all day long. It was like a full-time job, like more than a full-time job, trying to fight to get my son back. And I called an entity in Washington, and I asked them, I said, how can someone do this? How can someone just take your child from you like this? And his response to me was, because of years and years of no one speaking up. And when he said that to me, it just hit me. And I said, I will not suffer in silence. I will speak up. Because if this is happening, and this is truly happening to all these people, which I now know it is, I'm going to speak up. I'm going to speak up for Isaiah. I'm going to speak up for myself and all the other parents and children before and after us. And this is truly an epidemic. And if I would have heard my same story 9 months ago, I would have said probably, what did the mother do wrong? This can't be right. Because what I knew of DCFS and hospitals and doctors, DCFS intervenes when intervention is needed. I thought they were a good agency that helped children. I didn't know anything about them. They were just kind of over to the side. This is real, and I guess every case is different, but I do feel like people need to know. They need to be aware, and that is my reason for speaking up.
Okay. Michelle, I'd like some short answers to this, please.
Okay.
All right. How long have you worked in medicine as a registered nurse?
I'm a licensed practical nurse for 16 years.
Okay. Have you ever been in hospital working?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Have you seen doctors make mistakes with other doctors, nurses, in operations, and it be covered up?
Yes, I have seen errors. Absolutely, I have seen errors.
Okay. Have you seen people cover up the errors for each other? It's either yes or no. You either have or you haven't.
I don't know about cover up.
Well, no, hold on, please.
Sure.
It's important to be honest because we're trying to get you a national audience to become interested in your story because of the injustice that I perceive here, or I wouldn't be doing this show, and all the other people who haven't had an opportunity to air there. If you've seen an injustice is where a patient has been injured through no fault of their own because of a medical procedure or treatment, the doctors or nurses are aware that there's been a mistake, and instead of simply being honest about it, coming forth, acknowledging it, informing the patient or their family, they cover it up. Have you witnessed that or not? You either have witnessed it or you haven't.
Well, I can tell you that I've taken care of patients that have explained to those type of situations that were seeking treatment because of something that they received. So, yes, I've witnessed patients telling me, I'm here because this happened and I'm getting this procedure because this happened to me.
All right, one more question here for you.
Sure.
How often have you witnessed, not hearsay, just you, witness doctors or nurses working on a patient, whatever condition it may be, and they really had no answers. They were guessing. They were making it up as they went along. They were trying things. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm simply saying when there's not an answer, yet people have to do something, so they just do what they can. Have you ever experienced that?
Absolutely, with my son.
Okay.
Absolutely.
No, beyond your son. Have you ever seen it where other patients were treated this way?
Absolutely. Where they don't know what they're doing, so they're ruling things out, and they're going to try this, and they're going to try that, and okay, well, that didn't work, so let's just try this.
So yes. It becomes an experiment, right?
Right.
That's not based upon any actual sound science, because they have no proof that what they're about to do will work. They hope it does. Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't, it doesn't. Isn't it amazing that when they did the best they could with your son, but as you said, didn't you not tell us that they didn't know what they were doing? They had no answers. They were baffled, right?
My son was suffering.
Okay, but please.
That is correct.
Okay,
that
so they did, they did. I thought you said that they didn't have the answers. So in effect, they were. What they did was experimenting on your son, whether it was a medication to kill the pain. Again, I'm separating out their intent to try to help your son from what actually happened, which they didn't help your son. So when you became involved because it wasn't working, you becoming involved because of your background, because of your insistence, you then became the problem, not their incompetence or their lack of knowledge or the lack of positive results. That's all I wanted to make a statement on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do agree with that.
Let's listen now. We got her back on the line, Lori Blaylock. Nice to have you with us, Lori.
Hi, thank you.
Lori, would you tell the story of your daughter, Catherine, who was born this June, and what happened?
She was born with the cleft palate, Pierre Robin, and craniosynostosis. And she had been in and out of the hospital for failure to thrive. They finally got the Haberman bottle that was working at McLean Children's, her primary care hospital. At home with the Pierre Robin, she had an episode of an ALTI where she quit breathing. She was airlifted from my local hospital in Monahans up to Lubbock UMC. When she got there, she began having unexplained seizures, and they started medicating. And when they started wanting to try to feed her again through her bottle, she began aspirating. They put her on the feeding tube, and they eventually put in the G button. By then, they had her down just to the phenobarbital and Keppra for the seizures. They seemed to have had the seizures under control, but EEGs had shown seizure activity where there was no movement of her body, where you didn't know she was seizing. Prior to her discharge, they wanted to up the calories of her feeds. I was giving her expressed breast milk of my own and from a milk bank. When they wanted to up the calories of the fortifier, she is gluten and lactose intolerant, and I was not comfortable with traditional formula. So I had finally got them to work with me on the organic infant formula to fortify. Upon that, she started having episodes where she was urinating way more than the fluid she was taking in with her feeds. They went ahead and discharged her. 2 days later, she had small seizures at home, a 2-minute and a 5-minute and 56-second seizure. I took her back to my local ER. They sent her back to UMC in an airlift. Upon getting there, they was now late on 2 doses of phenobarbital. I had been giving the medicine the way they had taught me how, which was diluting the meds. I had 2 witnesses, adult witnesses, to giving the medication. Once we got to the hospital, they called CPS in and removed my daughter under the grounds of medical neglect, stating I wasn't giving the medicine. I showed the doctors and nurses how I drew up the medicine. They still took her. On their court orders, they had a doctor I'd never spoke with make a statement stating that I said I was not giving the correct dose, which I never said. And the therapeutic levels of the phenobarbital had went to 9.5 from a 10 in her body. The way the medicine was given was a 100 milligram tab of pyridoxine, the B6, crushed up into 2 to 3 mils of steri water.
Okay, we don't have time for that detail. The outcome has been what?
The court acknowledged the doctor's statement with the doctor I had never spoke to, refused my witnesses and took her a medical neglect, stating that I wasn't giving her her meds and they didn't feel I would give her medical treatment. And they put her into a medical foster home near the hospital.
And what are you doing to help change that situation as we speak?
I've hired an attorney, but I'm currently looking for a different attorney because he has not helped our case. We are working the service plan that the court did put in order, but I found out yesterday when they called me and overscheduled my service plan to make sure I could not finish it before a permanency hearing. And I'm going through every avenue I know, contacting anyone I feel may be able to help that has dealt with these medical kidnap cases to try and get my daughter home to find legal aid.
Well, you know now that Randy Kretschmar, who's in Chicago, is involved. You also know that there's a Citizens Commission for Human Rights that probably does more to be proactive on the part of abuses within the mental health field than any other organization. I would get them involved. I would get the media involved. I would have your case, write your case up, have it fully documented, and have witnesses, and then hold a press conference in front of the hospital to demand your rights. You can embarrass these people. I would do the same. Terry, who was investigating this, since it's kind of new to Terry, and but Michelle, I would hold a press conference, and I would get all the other parents that have documentation that their kids have been kidnapped for similar reasons, bring you all together. You have greater strength when you're unified. And Randy, you could look at the cases to make sure that they are legitimate, and then take them all forward as a major issue and get the national media involved, and then bring in a lawsuit against the hospital. The hospital, the doctors involved personally. When you sue the hospital, you sue the doctors, you hold a press conference, you bring this to their attention, at least you're no longer fighting without any public support or without anyone knowing the story. Randy, we'll close with you. Is that a reasonable approach?
Yeah, I'd love to see something like that, Gary. I think, you know, these people are up against a machine that is really finely tuned to just roll over their rights as parents. We had this purpose to protect children, and it's morphed into it's being abused. CPS has a legitimate function. Child Protective Services need to protect some children, but they're being used. They've been hijacked, and they're being used by wealthy hospitals and arrogant medical elitists to simply increase their own bottom line to get them out of tight spots.
Okay, here's what we'll do, Randy, because we're out of time. Your website is refusingpsychiatry.blogspot.com. I suggest that all the people listening who have a condition where they have gone through something similar to our guest contact you. I suggest that you create a national organization and take it forward at the national level and bring the lawsuit in Chicago. And you, from what I've seen, you have more than adequate grounds. And then go to the largest newspaper there, look for the people most likely to do a honest, objective story, present your story, and then let the media get behind you. Then let the mass of people get behind you. Then let the lawsuit get behind you. And then let other people become, if there's other parents from that same hospital, you could even possibly bring a class action suit. That's my suggestion. I wish you all the best. Randy Kretschmar and from Chicago, Terry LaPont, thank you, Terry, for reporting on all this as you did and the good work that you're doing. Michelle Ryder, I wish you all the best, and Lori Blaylock, both of you, and Dr. Feldman, thank you as well. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.